The speaker tonight is going to be Jordan Humphreys. Jordan has been a long-time member of the Sydney branch and is now one of our intrepid pioneers in the Wollongong branch in Sydney. Clearly has some fans in the room.
Regularism.
So Jordan, has been a long-standing member of Socialist Alternative. He's been really active in the refugee campaign in both Sydney and now in Wollongong. So he's going to speak for a while, and then, we're going to have plenty of time for discussion and debate if people so want, and then a few exciting announcements. So thanks, Jordan.
Cool. Thanks, Diane. How nice. Well, if you look at the Greens today, I think there are two key processes at work. On the one hand, there's the solidification of the party's evolution from the margins into the political mainstream, which is kind of the title of today, a process which has been going on for quite a few years now, but shows no signs of slowing down. And I think this is important because in the past it was common for some commentators on the left to argue that the kind of base of support for the Greens, was pretty weak, that the space between the Liberals and the LP was pretty small, that the way the electoral system was set up in Australia made it very hard for third parties to break out, and that the Greens might disappear like the kind of Democrats did before. For those people who remember them, I have no idea who they are particularly, but there you go, too young. And there's an aspect of truth to all those things, but I think it's pretty clear today that the Greens obviously are a serious kind of force in politics, and they're unlikely just to disappear, and so they're going to be continuing question for the left in Australia. So as I said, the Greens have managed to carve out a reasonably serious space for themselves in Australian politics, and this is particularly evident in the base they've built for themselves in several cities, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, in inner city areas in particular. And they've got now a layer of supporters there who have voted consistently for the Greens for some years, in some cases over a decade. And this has opened up the kind of possibility for them to win traditional ALP seats from the Labor Party, who've been held by them since basically seats were set up originally. And this is not to say that they have not or will not in the future suffer important electoral setbacks. The results in Batman are a case in point. But like I was saying before, it's highly unlikely they're going to disappear. And so it's an important question for socialists and people thinking critically about capitalism today to try and get their heads around is what kind of party is the Greens? I think the other process which has been going on has been the ongoing and so far mostly successful campaign against the more left-wing sections of the Greens, who have become disquieted by some of the most openly conservative expressions of the Greens' move into the mainstream. And this is primarily focused, as most people will know, on Lee Rhiannon and some of their supporters in the New South Wales sections of the Greens, who have suffered a very serious defeat with Lee, who lost her pre-selection campaign people might have been following at the end of last year. And it's periodically, been about other kind of figures in the Greens around the country as well, but primarily focused on Lee and the New South Wales Greens. And this combined with the entrenchment of the party as a left-wing adjunct, really, of mainstream Australian politics, has just reinforced what has been clear, for over a decade, if not really from the origins of the Greens itself, that whatever potential allies it had to develop into a left-wing alternative of the ALP has exhausted itself, if indeed it ever really existed. In reaction to both of these processes, two very different kind of narratives about the history of the Greens has been constructed. On the one hand, there's a story peddled by kind of the mainstream leadership of the Greens in Victoria and by Bob Brown, the right-wingers in Tasmania. And this is that while the earlier history of the Greens was very heroic and idealistic, and had very many kind of noble qualities, the party had to rightfully professionalise itself and shed itself of the kind of most loony parts of its past in order to position itself as a responsible alternative to the major parties. Against this, left-wingers and the party assert that the Greens' origins and the grassroots organising and leftist politics of ex-communists, anarchists and activists from the 1970s and 80s is a vital part of its continuing strength, particularly pointing to the kind of four pillars of the Greens people might or might not know, which are ecological sustainability, grassroots, democracy, social justice, peace and non-violence. And they hold these up as kind of core to the DNA of the party. However, it must be said that most of the discussion about the evolution of the Greens, including by people in the left wing of the Greens, is relatively superficial. To give an example, in October, I attended a forum on the future of the Greens, which was kind of a part of Lee Rhiannon's pre-selection campaign. It kind of kicked it off. And it was led by a range of kind of leading figures on the left in Sydney, particularly in the left wing of the Greens. And a bunch of what they said from the front, any kind of socialist critic of the Greens could agree with. Like they said, you know, the Greens have moved to the right over the last decade, that the leadership of the Greens had become decoupled from social movements and instead sought alliances with other political parties, the media and business in order to break into the mainstream. And then in particular, they said that the Greens had become ambiguous on class questions, which are central to society. But there was no real accounting of how the party had gotten from where it was to where it is today. In fact, the only thing people kind of say was, oh, you know, there's always problems that happen when you're very successful and you become bigger. Which, here's what's the point in becoming bigger if you just end up becoming more right-wing and kind of selling out? In order to get to the heart of this question, I think, we need a more serious kind of look at the evolution of the Greens and how it's related to class and capitalism in Australia. And this talk is, you know, a kind of contribution to that, I suppose. So, to look at the origins of the Greens. The Greens had its roots in the peace and ecological movements of the 1970s and 1980s. And the fact that the first generation of Greens activists were forged out of these campaigns makes it important to critically understand some of the dynamics of these movements in order to grasp some of the context for why the Greens formed the way they did. So throughout the 70s and 80s, tens of thousands, if not more, it's hard to calculate, were involved in campaigns against nuclear war, against uranium mining, and against environmental destruction. However, the context in which these campaigns were happening was when, overall, class struggle was in decline and radical politics was being pushed into retreat, really, in society, particularly following the coup against Gough Whitlam. And important social movements and industrial action kind of continued, but in a very different situation, a very different climate. There were very many bitter battles, but they ended, for the most part, in exhaustion and defeat, particularly in the union movement. And this context, the tendency was for class issues and environmental issues to become more and more disconnected from each other, rather than being seen as a part of a kind of common struggle. This was very clearly kind of shown in the case of the long-running battles between environmental activists and the Hydroelectric Commission in Tasmania, the HEC. And it was in response to these campaigns that the first kind of example, really, of the Greens as a political entity, the United Tasmania Group, the UTG, was formed. And this was formed in opposition to the destruction of Lake Pedlar in 1972. And, you know, they kind of failed in that campaign, but a much bigger campaign built up to try and stop the next attempt, which was to dam the Franklin River. And people might have heard of the Franklin River campaign. There was a bunch of articles about it recently. And the activists who had been involved in the United Tasmania Group in this campaign, particularly Bob Brown, would play a leading role in the Greens in the future and kind of around this issue. And having a look at this kind of shows some elements which would come to the fore as the Greens developed and kind of some of the conditions for their success, I suppose. The first was the role of the Australian Labor Party, which was pretty rotten, as people might imagine. The Labor Premier of Tasmania, Doug Lau, had announced in response to pressure from environmental activists that he was going to save the Franklin River and turn it into a national park. There was a right-wing historical campaign against him, and so he did what Labor politicians do, which is he backed down and capitulated. He decided to have a referendum on the issue in which there would be a pro-dam position, but there would not actually be no dams on the ballot. You weren't able to vote on that in the referendum. And in response to this, there was quite a dramatic result. 47% of people voted for the dam, 8% for the Labor Party's kind of compromise motion, and 45% voted informally. They just wrote no dams and put the thing in it, even though, you know, it was ruled invalid. Now, in response to this, the Australian Labor Party went into meltdown, kind of torn between its two positions. They ended up dumping the Premier as leader, and then they were smashed by the Liberals who ran on a hard pro-dam platform. In response to this, an immense campaign started. Hundreds of activists blockaded construction sites, scores of people camped in the area the dam was to be built, while others set out in dinghies to obstruct the work while facing police harassment. After 10 days, hundreds of people had been arrested as a part of these demonstrations and actions. And when Fraser called a general election the next year, the campaign heated up again, with a rally of 12,000 in Hobart, which is pretty big for Hobart, I presume, and direct action at the HEC HQ, with protesters wheeling themselves into a steel cage and hoisting a no dams flag on top of the building. Now, this direct action kind of element of the campaign, it's important to see this kind of critically. Like, it made it seem much more radical than in reality it was, and kind of obscured a series of the weaknesses, particularly the fact that overall it kind of ended up contributing to the right-wing trend in Australia's environmental movement. Kind of explain this a bit. Whereas previous campaigns around the environment had a strong working-class content, the Franklin campaign has depended much more heavily on backing from liberal sections of the ruling class, who did not particularly see the need or the necessity for having another big dam when Tasmania already had some huge power generation systems. You know, so a group of 60 Tasmanian businessmen, for instance, commissioned a report showing that the dam was actually not necessary, you know, even for kind of capitalist development there. And the protesters on the camp, for a period, camped in a 10-acre site that was provided by a local landlord and arrived on a cruise boat, which was organised by a local tourist firm. And the campaign attracted support from Dick Smith, the electronics capitalist, and funding, thanks, from the Prince of Wales and the Duke of Edinburgh, to give some idea about the kind of support. And that doesn't mean the campaign, you know, was crap or anything, but it tells you something about the politics behind it. The core activists involved were also a relatively elite group. They had been through special non-violence training, which was compulsory in order to join in the actions, and this, by definition, precluded the involvement of large numbers of working-class people. And this was reinforced by a lack of interest in even trying to win over trade unions or working-class activists in the No Dams campaign. So Bob Brown admitted in an interview in 1982, there's been a definite failing of the environmental movement and the unions to get together in Tasmania. To be honest, we've failed on that. After a couple of attempts, we've largely given up. The final element of the Franklin campaign, which pointed to the future direction of its leaders, was that for all the direct action and, you know, demonstrations occasionally, the activists were primarily interested in the electoral and parliamentary sphere, and this kind of came to the fore more and more as the campaign went on. They had set up branches in several marginal federal electorates as early as May 1982. In early March 1983, as it became clear Labor would win the election, the campaign was pretty much called off, with only a small watch camp being set up over the Franklin River. The battle, many activists said, was all but won. In fact, Bob Brown had predicted in late January that the Franklin would be saved by an election campaign, not by any blockades. And upon victory, and this is kind of a contradiction of it, Bob Hawke, who was elected in that election, did preserve the Franklin River. And this was an important victory after many defeats of the environmental movement, you know, before then and since. However, it bred dangerous illusions about the power of electoral parliamentary politics. At a time when class struggle and social movements were on the decline, it gave environmentalists a false feeling of power and gave a boost to kind of people who try to combine some non-violent direct action on the side with parliamentary politics on the other, since this appeared to work. And the reality that the victory is easier because important sections of the ruling class either opposed the dams or didn't really care about them was kind of brushed aside. And a series of these elements are important for the future development of the Greens. At this point, it might be objected that surely the origin of the Greens, though, in other places outside of Tasmania was very different to what was going on with Bob Brown. And the fact that it was in Sydney, you know, when the Greens were first kind of officially registered as a party. Now, it's true that there are important differences between the kind of Greens in different states, which help to explain a whole series of the divisions which are happening at the moment, the debates going on. However, as I hope to explain, there was a similar trajectory at work in the formation of the Greens groups in other states as well, particularly as they cohered together into a national kind of political organisation. So in New South Wales, the environmental movement had initially been more rooted in working class politics. The Greens had taken their name kind of for a very circuitous route from the Green Bands, organised by the Builders Labourers Federation in 1970s, who took industrial action to save environmentally significant areas. Similarly, the two kind of core layers of activists who came together to form the Greens in New South Wales had much more left-wing origins than the Franklin Dam campaigners. And one group emerged from left-wing Labour Party activists who were involved in the inner-city districts such as Balmain, and had been fighting a long-term factional struggle against the right-wing and very corrupt Labour Party apparatus in New South Wales, who had lots of links, particularly with developers, and weren't afraid to use, you know, all sorts of violence to kind of carry through their agenda. Like, they beat up left-wing activists who joined the Labour Party and tried to overturn it, for instance. Another section came from a layer of socialist activists, some of whom had been members of, you know, the various different communist parties, and who, as the organisation seemed to become more and more irrelevant, were seeking a new home for their political activity. However, I think on closer inspection, the differences are not as fundamental as one would think. It's true that the experiences of being bureaucratically screwed over by the state LP party had installed in those left-wing activists leaving to form the Greens a hostility to top-down organising and centralised power structures, which is reflected today in, like, the power that the State Delegates Council, for instance, has in New South Wales over Greens members elected from there. However, despite the libertarian language and talk of participatory democracy, they combine this with a very pragmatic acceptance of the importance of electoral work that mirrored the Franklin Dam campaigners. After all, many of these activists had been involved primarily in electoral work for some decades before they were involved in the Greens, and the core of their activity within the Labor Party, you know, they went to protests and organised that as well, but the core of that activity was about fighting with right-wing Labor people for control over party branches in the inner city, and primarily activism on a kind of local governmental level. There was nothing in the trajectory of this group of activists that pushed them to confront the limited nature of parliamentary politics, particularly when the trend of working class self-activity and militancy was on the downward swing. On the contrary, it pushed them to set up an alternative political apparatus to pursue change within the same parliamentary structure. And it was similar with those activists who were leaving the disintegrating communist parties. Following the end of the radical height of the 70s, the various communist parties had moved to the right as class struggles slowed down and left-wing politics retreated. The Communist Party of Australia, for instance, set up a whole series of kind of broader front organisations, the New Left Party, the Socialist Forum in Victoria, and already it was being openly discussed in the party that calling itself communist or even socialist was kind of old hat. It had nothing to do with the kind of post-USSR world. So while many of these activists were more left-wing than Bob Brown and his non-violent protesters, their trajectory overall was to the right. They were moving away from socialist politics and towards a more liberal view of the world and were seeking a political party that would express this evolution. It is a similar trajectory, albeit from different starting points, between the most conservative and most left-wing sections of the Greens that helps us to understand how they could slowly come together in the same political formation. There was convergence between these different groups which could be brought together around a common project, a new electoral party for the left. It was a similar story in a whole series of other countries as well, in which a whole series of ex-radicals and former communists were creating new electoral vehicles, primarily focused around the environment and often justified by a critique of Marxism as, you know, materialistic and unable to deal with the complexities of environmental politics. Another example which also raises a bunch of other questions is the German Greens, and particularly the origins of the four pillars of the Greens, which, as I was saying before, is often held up today. If people don't know, it's not often talked about that much. The four pillars were formed out of very hilarious circumstances, really. They were formed at a very fractious Congress of the German Greens in Offenbach in 1979, where one of the leaders of the German Greens was trying to bring the left and right together. He describes how he kind of came up with the four pillars. He writes, "I took a piece of paper and wrote four words on it: ecology, social responsibility, grassroots democracy, and nonviolence. Then I called the leader of the right wing of the Greens and leader of the left wing of the Greens into a room where all the journalists were lined up and told them to sign. We went back into the convention hall and announced that finally we had a program." Now, it's a little more than ironic that the four pillars which are held up today, particularly by the left of the Greens, as the kind of moral compass of the party, vital to stopping it from straying from its radical origins, were in fact a product of a compromise from the German Greens. In order to expand on the nature of this common project that the kind of different sections of the Greens were united around, I wanted to look at kind of two elements. First, the gentrification of inner city seats, and second, and kind of that creating a green space, and second of all, the space opened up by the crisis in the mainstream political parties. So originally I had a very long history of the gentrification of inner city seats, but that has been mostly scrapped, so you can all be thankful for that. The gentrification of inner city seats goes back, you know, for many decades, to the 1960s, some argue kind of earlier than that, and it had a significant effect on the evolution of those political parties that are rooted in there, the ALP and then the Greens later on in particular. It was driven, people might know, by the kind of exodus of industry from the inner city to the outer suburbs, the need of workers then to move close to their places of business where they work, and then middle-class people thinking, oh, the inner city is not as bad anymore, we've not as many factories and terrible places, so maybe we can move in there. So I won't go through all the history of that. Obviously, people will know some of the effects of it. It's quite common knowledge these days. To give just one kind of example, is the seat of Northcote in Melbourne, which people probably will know the Greens recently won from the ALP. In the 1990s, Northcote wasn't a particularly kind of wealthy area at all, but that roughly changed for the 90s and 2000s. To give an idea, from 1996 to 2006, the number of two-owner households rose by 10 percentage points. The share of households in the top kind of quintile of income rose from 14 to 19%. And from 2001 to 2016, the average weekly income in Northcote rose by 129%, faster than any other seat in Victoria. This gentrification was an important precondition for the Greens to establish themselves as a serious electoral party. It's provided them with a significant and, in many cases, growing social base. More, however, is a social base that is geographically located in electoral seats, which makes it very useful for elections, obviously, and in a way which kind of undermines some of its other rivals, particularly the Australian Labor Party. Now, this is not to say that the only people who vote for the Greens, are middle class. A significant layer of Greens voters are, university-educated white-collar workers and some blue-collar workers as well. However, the key social group in society the Greens orient towards is undoubtedly the middle class. And it's unsurprising that even those sections of workers who do look towards the Greens are the ones which are kind of closest either, in their thought or somewhat in reality to the middle class, culturally and a bunch of other kind of ways. Somewhat running over time, so I'm not going to go through a long thing about the middle class and kind of what they are. That's more something we can talk about in the discussion, I feel, particularly if people have questions about that. I want to talk a bit more about the kind of crisis of mainstream politics. The transformation of inner city seats, though, I think was not enough for a precondition for the rise of the Greens. Like, the middle class has been around for quite some time and in different geographical locations before, and has generally voted for one of the two major parties overwhelmingly. So why did this change? Why did a section of them open up to voting for the Greens? I think from the Whitlam coup onwards, the ALP began a steady march to the right, including an open embrace of neoliberal economics, right-wing positions, racism, a whole range of social questions, hostility to even kind of pretending like they supported militant trade unionism. And over this time, this process led to a feeling for many people that there was little difference between the ALP and the Liberals. Both embraced the market, globalisation, neoliberal counter-reforms, and they claimed that they couldn't do anything in the face of all of that, or they championed them as kind of great for humanity and workers. On the right, this expressed itself in things eventually like One Nation and some of the kind of right-wing populist politics that tries to relate to it. But on the left, the kind of Greens are trying to relate to that as well. And this crisis was exacerbated by the kind of declining social base of the Australian Labor Party, which, while sometimes kind of misunderstood or extremely exaggerated, has been an important development, particularly in inner city seats, where the Greens are kind of challenging them. The move to the right by the ALP has gutted a whole series of activists from the core of the ALP base, both blue-collar and white-collar workers, as well as even many left-wing kind of middle-class supporters have abandoned being actively involved in Labor, and in some cases even bothering to vote for it. And as I said, this is particularly expressed in a series of inner-city suburbs. And all of this was further entrenched as the ALP shifted kind of further to the right over the last couple of decades. And the space then for a party to carve out some kind of space, particularly of kind of white-collar workers and kind of middle-class progressives who had either voted for the ALP in the past, increased. The process of bringing this into reality, though, was quite slow. In 1989, there were 13 Green parties in Australia who were registered with AEC, and 18 different Green parties campaigned in the 1990 election. However, the trajectory the activists I discussed earlier, combined with the space opening up by some of the kind of developments I talked about, kind of pushed this process along. To give an idea about how this project cohered together and how the Greens started to be integrated into the mainstream, we just have to look at some of the developments of the Greens from 1989, when they held balance of power in Tasmania, to the 2001 election, when they first kind of started to break out federally. So, and people might not know some of this early history, maybe some of the older people do, but it's quite revealing. In 1989, five Greens were elected in Tasmania, giving them the balance of power in the state government. They quickly formed government with the ALP. And as Bob Brown and Peter Singer wrote shortly afterwards, is the only period, talking about this time, in Australian political history in which Greens have formally agreed to support a government, and so provides the best indication yet of how Greens can act when they can influence government policy. And they're right about that, but not in the way that they appear to be, I feel. And this also, you know, laid some of the basis what they'll do later on, you know, under Rudd, but particularly under the Gillard federal ALP government. So the 1989 Labor government quickly gave way to a Liberal government, which was also then backed by the Greens due to the balance of power situation. The Liberals then brought in vicious budget cuts, which were supported by the Greens. As Bob Brown said, there were savage budget cuts. We had Green supporters protesting outside our offices. We went to some very angry public meetings, but we Greens held the line. Yeah, gives some idea about Bob Brown. At the same time, the various Green state-based parties across the country were beginning to kind of cohere together and run more seriously in the federal elections and starting to build up a base on a local level as well. And this positioned them well to take advantage of some of the more left-wing things that happened in the 90s and 2000s, the S11 protests, for instance, the refugee issue, the Iraq War, etc., which showed that alongside the integration's mainstream politics, they could still position themselves as kind of a left within that. Yeah, so people maybe won't know, like during the anti-corporate kind of protest movement in the 90s and 2000s, the party was pushed to the left, definitely. You know, Bob Brown, you know, had been saying that crap about budget cuts, etc. And a few years later, he was with a bunch of other Green MPs at the Green Bloc outside the S11 anti-corporate protests, campaigning against kind of corporate power over ordinary people. And this is an important time, you know, thousands of young people being radicalised, etc., and showed that the Greens are able to relate to left-wing things. But out of contradictory development, like the refugee protests later, the Iraq War, these things allowed the Greens to open up a kind of new audience to themselves and something beyond just the environmental issues which they had talked about beforehand, which showed kind of how they could have success around broader issues. But it also, you know, kind of the difficulty of success is they were successful, but they also, over the long term, pushed them to the right and further conservatised them, brought them into kind of the mainstream. Before I talk about some of that in a bit more detail, though, I just wanted to look at some kind of the history of left-wing kind of opposition within the Greens to some of this stuff. Because left-wing disquiet within the Greens didn't start with Lee Rhiannon. In fact, it's been a constant thing throughout the history of the Greens. It's been some people within the party who have not liked, you know, some of the trajectory of what's been going on. In New South Wales, for instance, the Greens took a very long time, actually, to become a coherent party, partly due to big disagreements about kind of how parliamentary focus was supposed to be, about how it should be structured, about exactly what emphasis they should be putting on things, etc. And this led to the Greens almost falling apart for a whole period in the kind of late 80s and early 90s, and only really regrouping again in the mid-90s. Tony Harris, who was a founding member of the New South Wales Greens and one of those kind of ALP activists I was talking about before, was particularly torn by this kind of whole process, and he dropped out of active politics for a whole period. As he put it, those of us from the Annandale branch of the ALP who had taken the initiative in 1984 and hoped for a more, taking the initiative, you know, being in the Greens, hoped for a more federal and libertarian political formation, had seen the real politic writing on the wall and were prepared to a degree to lower expectations. However, some of us stuck around longer than others, but political exhaustion was taking its toll. Many of us simply decided to move on. Now, there's, you know, very important limitations to this discontent. That kind of Harris's critique is mainly about the content of, or it's mainly, sorry, about the form of the organisation, the form of their electoral intervention, rather than the political content behind that. So while he is more critical of parliamentary politics than some of the other Greens, he does not really have that radical of a perspective on it. And he likes to quote, like a lot of kind of left-wing Greens do, Patrick Kelly, who's one of the founders of the German Greens, who says, "For the Greens, parliamentary work should be of benefit to our many supporters at a grassroots level. It must never be undertaken for its own sake." That's like a nice kind of moral ideal, but doesn't really actually answer a bunch of the questions about the role of parliamentary politics for the left. And these ideas would also reappear kind of later within the New South Wales Greens, in the belief that a kind of decentralised organising model was some foolproof barrier to moderation and conservatism. And the weakness of this critique can also be seen some kind of years later, when Harris kind of ended up backtracking a lot of what he said and saying that my early 1990s judgments of the Greens were a little too pessimistic. And while they haven't turned out to fit some of the more radical dreams some of us had for it, Greens representatives in Australian parliaments have done pretty well overall in keeping the major parties up to the mark on a whole range of social, environmental and anti-war questions. And I think that kind of mood fits a lot of people in the Greens, particularly in New South Wales today. They're kind of It's not like they agree with all of it or think it's the most fantastic thing in the world, but they just kind of accept the way it's gone, and that's kind of pushed them in a more conservative direction over time. Another example of kind of a left within the Greens, which I'm not going to be able to talk about at all, was the Democratic Socialist Party, who were, you know, revolutionary socialists who were involved in the Greens from very early on, from 1989, particularly in New South Wales. They were expelled from the Greens in 1991, so it gives some idea about the hostility to people who actually were revolutionaries staying within the party. So in terms of the Greens breaking out as a political force, this really began, you know, kind of 2001, but particularly in 2004 elections onwards. The election of Adam Bandt to the seat of Melbourne in 2010 and his involvement in enabling the Gillard government to reign office gave him kind of national profile. The election of Jamie Parker at the 2011 New South Wales election, the seat of Balmain, gave the Greens a foothold in another lower house, to be followed by two more seats in the 2015 Victoria election and two in the New South Wales state election 2015. And when the four new Green senators took their seats in the Senate in July 2011, the Greens then held the balance of power in both houses of the federal parliament, which kind of propelled them really into the forefront of media attention. And there were widespread illusions by lots of people that the Greens would offer some kind of opposition to, and perhaps maybe even reverse, some of Labor's right-wing agenda when they came to power, particularly after people's experiences of the Rudd years, which at first people thought maybe were right, but kind of ended very much in disappointment. However, after signing a deal to support the minority government, the Greens settled into, for the most part, voicing pretty mild criticism of the ALP on some issues, and doing very little to mobilise opposition to their policies. Yeah, so, and it's not, and this was not actually that surprising. And the Greens gave a lot of warning that this was kind of in the offing. Rob Brown, for instance, in an interview just before the 2010 election, proclaimed that the Greens had shown a responsibility that the coalition had shunned. We've been able to negotiate better incomes time and again, and we'll do so in the next parliament. And in August 2010, Bob Brown gave an interview where he said that he was totally willing to, you know, depending on the circumstances, support not only a Labour minority government, but a Liberal minority government if it came to that. And this was a sign of their great kind of responsibility towards the people of Australia. In the event, the Greens committed to 3 years of responsible so-called government and stability at all costs. And this was a real right-wing drag. Like, stability on a governmental level is not a good thing for workers, particularly when it's a government which is committed to pursuing a neoliberal agenda, as the Gillard government definitely was. And the Greens' commitment to stable government made it inevitable, especially in the context of Labor's right-wing agenda, that they would end up becoming kind of the enforcers of Labor's policies, rather than radical critics of it mobilising against it. Yeah, and at the same time, on a kind of more state-based level, the Greens were propelled into kind of power, in coalition again, and Tasmania, and pursued a whole series of extremely right-wing things. And Nick McKim, who's held up as kind of a hero these days for a bunch of things he says, which are good about refugees and Peter Dutton being a fascist and whatnot, played a pretty grotesque role, actually. He accepted a ministerial portfolio in the 2010 Tasmanian Labor government, which was kind of formed. This government oversaw a 10% cut to spending, which meant 1,700 public sector jobs were cut. Increased water costs were introduced, public housing rents were increased, and $190 million was cut out of public education. And the Greens explicitly sided themselves with the government around this. They went to meetings with Labor ministers to defend the policies and explain them to trade union members, even when they were booed. So, for instance, Casey O'Connor, who was involved in that, as well as O'Brien, as a Labor minister, got up and said about the Labor minister, she has the courage and she's telling the truth about what's needed for the budget. And Greens leader, Nick McKim, stood down 56 guards at the Risdon prison without pay and brought in the cops to smash up their industrial action when they tried to take a stand, which was pretty appalling. Anyway, another example is when the budget came through in 2011 in Tasmania, Nick McKim declared, just as the Greens supported previous Labor and Liberal minority governments, when tough remedial budget action was required, we have rolled up our sleeves to take on a similar responsible role once again. The Greens welcome the move to a new fiscal strategy. New fiscal strategy being cuts for workers. It's really quite appalling. And this was reflected in the federal level as well. So Bob Brown, for instance, in his budget reply speech in 2011, argued that This is not a Greens budget, it is a Labor budget. The Greens will deal responsibly with all budget legislation on its merits. We will not block the budget or supply, but we will look to improve it, you know, where we can do so in a fiscally responsible manner. However, in order to ensure stability in government, the Greens will not be supporting any oppositional move which aims to wreck the budget. So it's pretty appalling. And the fact that the Greens became more and more tied to the increasingly unpopular Labor government meant that it made it very difficult for them to build support amongst workers and students. It became more and more fed up with Labor's right-wing agenda. And over time, the election results started to collapse in response to that. To give an idea, the longer this went on, the more the fate of the Greens was bound up with the Gillard government, as I was saying, and the more certain it became that, you know, Tony Abbott, this right-wing nut job, was going to win the election. What was more even disappointing, though, because you could have expected that from the right-wing of the Greens, really. As I said, they didn't particularly make it, unclear what they were open to doing. The left of the Greens offered no resistance or opposition to this, really, as well. When Peter Whish-Wilson, this outrageous corporate banker, was brought into the Greens, Lee Rhiannon enthused about him joining. She said, "When you come to talk about dark greens, light greens, etc., and about division, once again it's shown to be wide off the mark. I very much welcome Peter. We'll be working together in a collaborative way on a whole range of projects." We all know how that ended, very collaboratively. The LP government collapsed. People went out in disgrace to the polls, and Tony Abbott was able to win the election. The Greens had become increasingly bitter about kind of being tied to this government, but they were unable to come up with any kind of alternative strategy to break for them. And kind of the result of that was that the Greens' primary vote dropped almost a quarter, from 11.8% in 2010 to 8.7%. Once Abbott was in power and the Greens were out of it, they were able to regain some support somewhat. However, they're not able to kind of seriously learn any lessons out of this experience today, which is a very problematic thing for the future as we enter into the possibility of the future Labor government. The mainstream leadership of the Greens continue to fudge the question of with whom it will work with in a future government and on what basis. Something confirmed by Richard Di Natale's declaration that he would relish to serve as health minister in a future Greens Labor government, which Labor said they wouldn't have him, but there you go. The left is more hesitant about this, but doesn't really have a consistent or coherent approach against it. So in the forum I said before, Lee Rhiannon was going to ask about what's your position about forming these kind of governments. She said that she would rule out for now either supporting a minority government or entering into a coalition government on the basis that we Greens are not experienced enough to balance between the needs of the movements and the demands of government and responsibility. But still, this doesn't actually answer the question, when is the point in which they are experienced enough to balance between these two forces, apparently. It kind of just pushes things into the future. Well, despite the lack of a serious fight by the left wing of the New South Wales Greens against the right wing trajectory of the party, they have come under concerted attack from the leadership for years now. And this is because while they don't oppose the fundamental approach being taken by the Greens, they are opposed to and sometimes willing to publicly oppose some of the most right-wing expressions of the Greens' integration into mainstream politics. And something which really enrages the Greens' leadership and kind of mainstream ones, who feel like they're on the cusp of victory. Any second now they could break out, and the only people holding them back are like Lee Rhiannon and the kind of Looney Tunes people in New South Wales. That's the kind of way they see it. So to give some examples, in 2010, Greens councillors moved a successful motion in Sydney's Macclesfield Council supporting BDS in support of Palestine. And even though that was actually New South Wales Greens policy, so it was all the official kind of rules that they followed, Bob Brown attacked the decision, and the Greens who were involved in it, quite publicly. And in the end, he managed to force two of the Greens councillors to reverse their position, and it was reversed out of Marrickville Council, and they lost the support for BDS. Since then, the focus of the kind of attacks on the right have been on Lee Rhiannon and kind of people's supporter, and on the kind of structures of the New South Wales Greens more generally. Bob Brown has been kind of the most vicious about this. He's particularly likes to talk to The Australian, who seems to become best friends of these days, and the kind of various other mainstream media outlets. In one interview, he declared that Lee Rhiannon is the Tony Abbott of the Greens when it comes to political white-anting. And this is backed up by a kind of whole right-wing campaign within the New South Wales Greens itself, who have argued that they are being bullied and intimidated by the left-wing Greens, have set up a no-nastiness faction, as people might know, to kind of cry in their corner about this. And it's really just about attacking the left and saying that they shouldn't be criticised for their various right-wing ideas. So this hysterical campaigning, backed up by the mainstream media, reached its height with Lee being disciplined by the party during the negotiations with Turnbull over education policy. And this is a clear left-right issue. Turnbull was trying to push for a reactionary education policy. The education unions were opposed to that policy. Lee put out a leaflet, saying she agreed with the unions. She was against this kind of negotiations. In response to that, the Green leadership decided to discipline her by suspending her from the party room and being involved in those negotiations. This was kind of like an overreach. In the end, the right weren't able to get everything they wanted, but it didn't lead to the left and the Greens surging forward, trying to change the party overall. It just left them kind of defending their own turf in New South Wales, which is, for the most part, what they want and what they kind of conceive of, and kind of left the fight for another day, which was very unfortunate. This has opened up the space for the Greens leadership to back a candidate to get rid of Lee as the New South Wales senator for the party. And this time they chose not an openly right-wing candidate, but rather Maureen Faruqi, who's seen as kind of on the left of the party. The reality, though, was clear that she was being backed by the right to get rid of Lee. So she was definitely a right-wing candidate in that sense. And people interstate might not get a sense of this. On the surface, the Greens campaign seemed all very nice because there's all these stupid policies where you're not allowed to criticise anyone openly. You're not allowed to publicly comment on the other candidates. They think this is democratic or something. This is appalling, really. But underneath the surface, there was a vicious and hysterical campaign built up against Lee Rhiannon. To give some idea, the right wing of the Greens and the kind of soft left around Maureen called repeated Greens members' meetings to discuss transphobia and racism within the Greens, by which they meant Lee Rhiannon. They accused her of being a racist and a transphobe. Jenny Leong, who's another kind of soft left member of the Greens, mandated one of the supporters of Lee Rhiannon to come to a meeting of Community Action Against Homophobia and accuse us of being transphobic. Because we were having Lee Rhiannon speak at one of the rallies and demanded that another Green speaker, who's not even trans, but their partner is trans, to speak instead. And if we didn't do this, then we're all horrible people. And there was a constant implication that voting against Maureen was Islamophobic, because she was a Muslim woman. And how dare you vote against that? That's because Lee is secretly some kind of Islamophobe. Even though, obviously, she's one of the most prominent people in the Greens arguing against that kind of stuff. Against this is important to see, though, the left wing of the Greens whinged a lot. That's how I know about all this, obviously. They talked to people around the left about it, but even they admitted that they did very little to rebut the attacks. Often they just said, oh, there were all these attacks in meetings, we didn't know what to say, so we didn't even say anything. So it was like a barrage of attacks against her, and they just kind of accepted that. This has also kind of confirmed that once Lee was solely was defeated in the pre-selection, in the lead up to that, all these kind of people on the left of the Greens have said how they're going to have hour by hour commentary, breaking down the results, arguing what's the way forward for the Greens afterwards. After she was defeated, it was just silence. Nothing for days. None of them wrote anything, said anything about what happened, and wouldn't even talk to you about it for days afterwards. You'd come up to them, and they'll scroll away, not wanting to talk to you about what had kind of gone on with Lee Rhiannon. And in the end, most of them end up just saying, oh, I've heard that Faruqi is just as left wing as Lee, so maybe it'll turn out to be fine in the end anyway. So that gives some idea about the left of the Greens in New South Wales. Onto a different issue, though. The weakness of the Greens, including its most left-wing elements, I think, has also been kind of more clearly revealed over the last several years by the revival of genuine left-reformist organisations and currents internationally, particularly in Europe and North America. Before then, it was clear if you looked at it, but it's kind of more, I think, obvious, and there's more examples you kind of point to. Before then, it could seem like anything that was just not the Australian Labor Party was some amazing step forward for the left and the only alternative to building small revolutionary groups. However, with the emergence of Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the British Labor Party, the kind of enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders, the various kind of radical left parties that have been set up across Europe, Podemos, Syriza in a different period, Mélenchon, etc., have shown what left-wing but not revolutionary kind of politics can look like. And in the process, I suppose, the Greens look pretty crap and pretty timid and pretty moderate in comparison, whatever the kind of weaknesses of those various parties I mentioned before. They have all in different ways raised the issue of class to the centre of political debate in the country they are from, and they've popularised left-wing politics as being rooted in class rather than just in identity or culture. And they have also generally, you know, to different degrees, of course, tried to connect social justice issues such as racism, war, and the environment very clearly to class issues and been quite successful for doing so. You know, Corbyn, you know, people probably heard a bit about him. You know, a little while ago, he gave a very good speech talking about how Britain hasn't been involved in a just war since World War II and saying that attacks on refugees and migrants are about dividing the working class and helping the rich rule over this. And even though he's not a revolutionary, the whole way he talks is very different, I mean, even to some of the most left-wing people in the Greens. It's also interesting that since the global financial crisis and the whole kind of politicisation that's resulted from that in the United States and Europe, the Greens parties have not been the kind of reciprocal of that discontent and that radicalisation society. They have not been the things that should be able to relate to them in those countries. They have not been the things which have, you know, pushed forward protest movements, or kind of left-wing politics, even the parliamentary sphere. And I don't have time to go through all the kind of different examples. Ireland's probably the kind of classic example people might know about. The Greens there are involved in a coalition government when the GFC actually hit, and they carried out enormous budget cuts across the country aimed at the working class. And in response, in 2011, they were wiped out. Like, they lost every single elected person in the parliament because people were so fed up with what was going on. The German Greens are the kind of classic example of kind of the responsible managers of capitalism, the coalition kind of mongerers. The saying about them that they're neoliberals on bikes is very true. Even in places where they're not as openly right-wing as, say, the UK, for instance, they've still suffered a whole series of problems. So, for instance, the Greens kind of were the recipients somewhat at first of growing class anger about inequality, and their membership, for instance, increased from 20,000 to 47,000 in 2015 after the Labour Party were savagely defeated when they ran on a right-wing basis. However, pretty much all of this has been lost since Jeremy Corbyn has started to run the British Labour Party. And now it's very hard for them to position themselves to the left of Corbyn. Sometimes they actually position themselves to the right or in just kind of a stupid way compared to him. So to kind of come to some conclusions about this whole process, and hopefully people have a bunch of questions, the point of this talk was not to like compare the Greens to like the Bolshevik Party and like, you know, Bob Brown to Lenin, Lee Rhiannon to Trotsky or some other member of the Bolshevik Party perhaps. It's about kind of trying to explain why, even if you're trying to think about the Greens as like something like, you know, Sanders or the British Labour Party or some genuine expression of left kind of reformist class politics, they don't mark up to that in any serious way. And there's no real idea that they will do so in the future. Every year they move further away from being a party that can structurally relate to that, whatever the kind of rhetoric that they have. And the Greens are very, on one level, they're a very strange party. On some level, some of their politics are kind of in the past. They're a product of kind of the 80s and 90s, the kind of environmentalist, kind of semi-anarchist politics that existed around then, in which case they don't have that much of a future. And to the extent their politics kind of are embodied in the future, it's in a bunch of the kind of ideas I've outlined already. The kind of future image is of the German Greens, or that kind of style of party, or one that looks towards coalition governments, which, you know, talks about how great the gig economy is and how we should be a part of the future internet kind of world, rather than seeing that as just another expression of capitalist exploitation. I think what we really need is a serious alternative to the Labour Party based on left-wing class politics. Obviously, what kind of alternative that is, you know, there's a whole series of debates about that, reformist, revolutionary, etc., but I'm not talking about that today, so for other sessions. I'll leave that there.